Thank you, Peter. We'll hand over now to Sally-Ann for some New Zealand perspective.
Well, good afternoon. My job is just to put the development of forensic DNA in this country into the perspective that Peter's just given you. So in 1990, DNA profiling evidence was first presented in a New Zealand court. It was a two-year development process to get to that point. The case was Queen versus Pengelly, in which the suspect had had left blood at the scene, which was subsequently linked or compared with his reference sample. The technology that we used in that case was the same as that shown by Peter in almost his second slide, I think. It was called multi-locus probes, and it was developed by Alec Jeffries and Peter and others in the mid-1980s. Many of you would be aware, at least I hope you would be aware, that about that time and through the early 90s, there are a series of very serious sexual assault rapes occurring in South Auckland, which were eventually found to be committed by one of two men, either Joseph Thompson or Malcolm Rewa. And it was the use of forensic DNA evidence that we were developing that time that was very important in linking together the crimes and then finally linking the suspects to the crime. First of all, Operation Park. This DNA testing was done using a sort of second generation of DNA profiling, which was called single locus probes, and there's an example of one. We should see an example of one on your screen. And this was a reasonably time-consuming process. Took several weeks to actually do this testing, but using that, we were able to link together 15 rapes over a 10-year period, and also to eliminate about 700 individuals from committing those crimes, and then to link Joseph Thompson to them. Operation Harvey, however, we had all, as a consequence of Operation Park, we had discovered that there was a second series, if you like, of linked cases, one of which was the Susan Burdett homicide inquiry from 1992, I think. And we did eliminate an awful lot of people using the same technology, but we also started to develop the short tandem repeat technology that we still use today. This was an early form of it, and we only tested three DNA sites as opposed to the 15 DNA sites that we do now, using both the single locus system and the newly developed CTT system. We were able to link further cases, and we were able to eliminate well over 3,000 men from committing those crimes. And it was these two cases particularly that proved or provided the impetus for the establishment of our own national DNA database, which was the second national DNA database and came into being in 1996. And Malcolm Rewa was one of the first people, in fact may have been the first person, to give a sample under that legislation. The legislation was enacted on the 12th of August and his sample was taken on the 13th. So the technology that we've used since 1995 until now has changed quite a bit. We started off using three of these loci, which is the sort of photograph-looking type image. We progressed from that to what was called the SGM in 1996, which is what we initially used for the DNA database, and that was also used by the Forensic Science Service in the UK. That enables DNA profiles to be digitized into a series of numbers. So the colored peaks at the bottom of your slide could be turned into a set of numbers that could then be loaded into a database, which is effectively a very large Excel spreadsheet. We've gone from 6 to 10 in 2000, and now in 2007 we expanded again to 15 STR loci. in going along with that have been changes to the legislation as well. So the first piece of legislation that allowed for the establishment of the data bank was the Criminal Investigations Blood Samples Act of 1995. That was amended in 2003 to allow us to take buccal samples as well as blood samples for the purpose of the DNA data bank. And that was a big step forward because the samples that could be taken much easier than taking a blood sample from people. And there were some other changes to the legislation at that point, but in fact this was the biggest change for us. And you'll be aware that later this year, 1st of July, I believe, a new piece of legislation or an amendment, the Criminal Investigations Bodily Samples Amendment Act 2009, comes into force, and this will allow the police to take samples from people who have been charged of a relevant offence. So a slightly different criteria for the police to use when they're taking samples for the databank. So what does the DNA databank look like today? Well, we don't have 5 million people on our DNA databank. We have just over 105,000 now. We have 23,000 profiles from crime samples, so blood swabs and burglaries, semen samples from rape cases, that kind of thing. Our link rates are 65% for crimes to people. So for every 100 crime samples we load, we link 65 of them to a particular person, and 34% linkage between different crimes. And the total number of links that we've reported back to the police to date is 15,000. And one of the things I was asked to talk about was the research program that we have underway at ESR. We have a number of postdoctoral scientists and students working in forensic science to develop and research the new ideas for the future. And I haven't included all of them here, but I've just included a couple for you to have a look at. The first one is looking at the better use of plant material associated with crime scenes. So what type of material is transferred? How long does it persist? How is it best to analyse that material? We're doing a lot of work with DNA profiling of cannabis, for example, at the moment. We're also doing some work looking at differentiating between the psychoactive forms of cannabis and the forms that are used to grow for hemp. We have a fairly well-established, what you might call social science research program as well. We're looking at how the public, people like yourselves, the general public, juries, other professionals in the justice system actually perceive what we do, whether or not what we talk about in court makes sense to anybody, how useful that is, and what the outcomes are for society as a whole. And one new technique which we're about to introduce into the lab about halfway through this year is using a different sort of nucleic acid, not DNA but RNA, to identify different body fluids and tissue types. For example, menstrual blood, brain matter, fecal matter, saliva, all sorts of different body fluids in a sample that we just can't do at the moment. So I think we're now around to answer some questions, if you'd like to. We'll try not to talk across each other.
Certainly. Thank you very much, Sally-Ann and Peter. So I've just unmuted everyone on the line. So if you do have a question, please go ahead now. Please state your name and organisation before you do. So go ahead, anyone on the line who has questions.
Hi, it's Rebecca at NZPA here.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
Just a very quick question. Do you find, and I don't mind who answers this one, do you find that since programs like CSI have been running on television, it's a lot easier to explain the concept of DNA to people, including juries?
No, I sort of briefly allude to the CSI effect, and I don't think it helps at all because that doesn't really represent the way in which forensic science works. And my concern with programs like that is that it gives the impression that if there is a DNA profile found at a crime scene and you have a suspect, then it doesn't necessarily follow that the suspect is actually guilty of that crime. There are a lot of other things which must be considered. So I would prefer to be very cautious in that respect.
And my answer to that question would be it makes a false expectation about what can be done. That people think you can do more than you actually can on any given case.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. Any other questions there?
It's Karen Chugg here from the Dominion Post.
Go ahead, Karen.
Hi, I've got a question for Sally-Ann, I think, and that is just whether you think that this issue of the importance of interpreting results and that being something where in Europe scientists need to get better at is perhaps we've got a similar situation in New Zealand.
Well, we're really fortunate because at ESR, you may have noticed in some of Peter's slides, we have Dr. John Buckleton, who works for us and also works very closely with Peter and others in this area. So I think it would, from what I know, from what I see, it would be fair to say that we are probably at the forefront of implementing the current state of interpretation and all things interpretation actually into casework. Another reason for saying that is we're a small national laboratory. There is only one DNA laboratory, and so we are able to pick up and implement things very, very quickly. So if a new or an improved method or for interpretation or even just for DNA profiling in general or any other forensic science method comes up in the scientific literature, that the pathway to implementation for us is very short compared to a larger laboratory or a more fragmented system. So that just for once there's an advantage in being small.
Thank you.
Any other questions there online?
Yeah, John Hudson from Television New Zealand.
Go ahead, John.
Do you foresee a time when there will be a global DNA database?
Only in respect that we have an Interpol standard, and it is fairly routine. If a crime which was committed in New Zealand, and it was suspected that a UK citizen was responsible, it would be possible to compare that DNA profile with the UK DNA database, for example. So the way in which it will probably be developing is there won't actually be a huge, massive database. It's going to develop more like a Google search engine. So you'll have all the national DNA databases throughout Europe or the rest of the world. And there will be, you have to take account of national legislations, which are all different. And that means that maybe in one country it will only be people who have committed a certain crime who will be allowed to be on this global database. So there'll be a number of filters, but it will almost certainly operate rather like a Google search engine, if you see what I mean. So it'll be more like a virtual database.
Any idea when that might happen?
Well, it's happening in Europe now. So, for example, a DNA profile which is downloaded in Germany will automatically search the Austrian database. So this is developing as we speak. I don't know what the timelines are on this.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Anyone else here with a question?
Yeah, I've got one, John.
Ian Stewart here from.
Oh. Ian, do you want to go ahead first?
Oh, thanks. It's Ian Stewart from the press here. Those matches that you don't make, where they're not a positive identification, Is the science advanced to a point where you can say, for the sample we do have, this person has these characteristics or these traits?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by traits.
Are you able to look at a DNA sample and from that determine hair colour?
I see what you mean, things like hair colour, skin colour. There is actually a lot of research going on in this area. So for example, there's a red hair marker. But all of these markers are not definitive. So, for example, with red hair marker, you would only be, say, 80% certain that an individual had red hair if you discovered this particular gene. So the commonplace characteristics which are being worked on at the moment, hair colour, eye colour, skin colour, I think that's more or less covers it. In the future, it might be possible to do things with facial characteristics, for example. But this is quite a difficult area because there are many genes involved with things like that.
Excellent, thanks.
I think there was another question there just before Ian's.
That was me, Peter. Will here at Radio New Zealand.
Go ahead, Will.
You mentioned earlier, Dr. Gill, that DNA was first used to exonerate a suspect.
Yes.
And that there was then there were 5,000 samples taken. Did they lead to the actual the finding of the actual person who committed that crime?
No, they didn't. I didn't have time to go into the full story. But very briefly, what happened was these 5,000 people were sampled, and every one of them was excluded. And what had happened was that the perpetrator had persuaded another individual to go in his stead. So he actually pretended to be this guy. And the way it was discovered was that the guy who had pretended to be the perpetrator took the other guy's identity, was overheard talking about it in a pub, and that led to his discovery. So it sort of led to the discovery of the real perpetrator in a rather roundabout way, if you see what I mean.
That's okay. I've got one other question as well.
Yeah.
Have there been any assessments of how cost-effective DNA investigations are in getting eventual convictions? You know, a dollar invested in DNA forensic, how would that compare to a dollar invested in other types of police work?
ESR, the short answer is no, but people are working on it. So ESR's invested fairly heavily in trying to demonstrate that. The problem comes because some things are very hard to quantify. So, for example, things like if you apprehend a rapist early, how many rapes do you save? How much time off work is that for the victims? Those sorts of things are really hard to get some sort of sensible figure for. But we have done some work on that line, and I'm pretty sure that probably the New Zealand police have done something similar from their perspective. So it might be worth asking them.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Will. Any other questions there?
I've got another one.
Sure.
Sally-Ann, what's the turnaround time in New Zealand? How long does it take to get for the police to send you a sample to get a result back?
Well, it depends. At the moment, if it's an urgent... You know, a critical sample in a very urgent case, and we put everything else off and work on one sample, we can do that in sort of 2-3 days. If it's a case that requires one of our crime scene laboratories to search a large number of items, select samples, send in perhaps 20 or 30 samples for DNA testing, it probably takes between 5 or 6 weeks or so. One of the problems is that it's not always the case that everything arrives at the same time either. So the crime scene work might come first, and then perhaps, you know, a suspect is apprehended later on, and then an abscess items come in. So it can vary quite wildly, actually. But you know, within a couple of months, usually.
Right. And just one other thing. Can you just explain a bit more about the RNA technique you were talking about? I didn't quite understand that.
Sure.
How is it different to DNA? What advantages?
Yeah, no, that's easy. So all of your different body tissues, we all have the same DNA in all of our cells, but your blood cells are blood cells because they are making particular proteins that turn them into blood cells. Does that make sense? So what we're looking at, we're not looking at the proteins that make your blood cell a blood cell, but we're looking at the intermediary, the RNA that comes between the DNA and the protein. So it's called messenger RNA, and it's the part of your DNA that's copied and then turned into proteins. So a blood cell will have different RNA being turned on, is the expression, being copied, than a sperm cell will, or a cell in your mouth, in your saliva. So different cells have different populations of RNA molecules, and that's what we're trying to measure, are measuring.
So you're trying to find out where the DNA has come from?
That's the idea, yeah. At the moment, we have some techniques for that, obviously. We have techniques for blood, and we have some for semen, we have some for saliva. Some of them aren't particularly specific, so other things might react with those tests. For example, some of them are not human specific either. So that's the aim of the game, is to sort of expand the range of body tissue types that we can identify and in a human specific manner.
Right. And can you give me a real world example of how that could be useful?
Absolutely. Saliva on a vaginal swab. So at the moment, we have no method to positively identify saliva from the mouth on a vaginal swab. And the reason for that is that in vaginal fluid, there is another molecule that behaves much like the protein that we're trying to detect in the mouth. So you can't tell them apart, basically. But with our new test, we will be able to. So we will be able to say that saliva from the mouth is on an internal swab, which we can't currently do. And that's probably 30% of our casework would include those types of samples. So that's one example.
Is that work done overseas at the moment?
No.
So would we be the first country?
I don't know if we will be the first. There is a laboratory in Switzerland that is very active in this area and who we collaborate with and share ideas with. There's also a research laboratory in America, but I don't believe that they're going to actually implement. They don't do casework themselves, so I'm not sure how they're going to transfer that technology into a lab, but it's certainly we're going to be one of the first.
And sorry, Sally-Anne, but just to go back, did you say that you'd be hoping to use this by the middle of this year?
Yeah. All the research is done, we just have to get the standard operating procedures written and quality assurance trials completed, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have cases that are awaiting this
no.
technique?
No, not really. We do, every now and then I see a case where I think it would be useful, but we haven't put cases aside, although we can always go back to them later.
Right.
We probably will start to do that fairly soon.
Okay, any other questions there? Maybe I'll just put one out there from Kent Atkinson at NZPA, who emailed me a question earlier. It's about familial DNA. Kent asks, I would like to know the extent to which DNA found at a crime scene, which does not exactly match that of someone in the government's forensic DNA database, can still be used to pursue suspects. Is familial DNA testing likely to be used as a crime-solving technique in New Zealand? And to what extent is its potential here undermined by the genetic bottlenecks in the ancestry of indigenous populations such as Maori and Polynesians? In what specific cases has familial DNA linkages led police to the person they eventually prosecuted? Sally Ann.
Right, that's a question for me. So Peter did talk about how familial DNA testing is done. So what happens is that close relatives share a proportion of their DNA, and the way that familial DNA testing happens is that we look for candidates on or in a given, you know, on the DNA data bank that share a particular proportion of their DNA with a sample from a crime scene. So that's how that works. And we can talk about that more if you want to, but just moving on to the second part of the question, yes, it is used as a crime-solving technique in New Zealand. We only use it in very specific cases. So, for example, obviously you wouldn't use it if you already had a link on the DNA database or already had a suspect identified. So you only use it when you don't have someone. And to give you some idea about how often we would use this, I just did a bit of a quick count, and I think we've probably used it in 12 cases so far, somewhere around that number. And we have positive results, if you like. We have identified suspects in two of those, and the most recent one, which I'm sure you all remember, was the identification of Mr. Rikers, who was the suspect in the Marie Jameson homicide. And he pled guilty at the end of last year, and there was much media interest in that case. There's one other, which I don't have the details of with me, from about 2 years ago, and that was in Christchurch. The other, so both of those cases resulted in guilty pleas. The other question was to do with the problems or potential problems with the genetic makeup of Polynesians, Maori and Polynesian Pacific Islanders, and the technology that we're using on the National DNA Database doesn't suffer from genetic bottlenecks in the way that some other DNA testing does. So basically there is no problem, there is no effect of genetic bottlenecks with the particular DNA types that we use. So that's not a problem for us. I think that probably answers the question.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Sally. And any final questions there? No? Okay. In that case, I think I'll close by thanking Dr. Peter Gill and Dr. Sally-Ann Harbison. I'll point out that both our speakers are around for the next 15 to 20 minutes if anyone would like one-on-one interviews. Both of them will be here at the Science Media Centre, so call through on our main number if you have a desire to talk to them. So that's 04-499-5476. Now, the presentations you've seen today, they will be posted to the Science Media Centre website within the next half hour, and there will also be an audio recording posted to the website as well, so you can play that back. So thank you very much for your time and for your questions. We look forward to seeing you at another Science Media Centre briefing soon. Thank you very much.